Ground control to Major Tom.
I'm not Major Tom, your wife.
Oh, sorry. So check. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Here I am.
Check. Check your privilege.
Yeah.
Check your privilege.
Woo!
All right. So are the little needles moving on the giant console, the huge antiquated dials and things sparking and giving off heat? Hang on.
Say something.
Okay, my real fear is that we sit here and talk for like an hour and a half and we have a brilliant, never-to-be-repeated conversation.
and then
I get done and I go look at the thing and it's like recorded nothing.
Oh.
Anyway, so this time I actually did some prep, and this is about all the prep time I possibly could spend, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which is, I took like an hour and a half and I actually wrote an essay.
Yeah. No, that goes a long way.
And it's not very well edited because I didn't get a chance to revise it.
Just an hour and a half, but
this is the time I had. So I'm going to read this as a starting topic.
Sure.
And then we'll do some more topics after this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I first heard about Verit when Clinton retweeted an announcement about the launch of their website. Actually, I don't follow Clinton on Twitter, so what I really noticed was Keith Olbermann responding to her. Clinton tweeted, "I'm excited to sign up for Verit, a media platform for the 65.8 million. Will you join me and sign up too?" And Olbermann responded snarkily, but I think actually wisely, "Madam Secretary, I think your account may have been hacked." The link that Clinton shared was to an article on a new website. The headline of the article is "Introducing Verit Media for the 65.8 million." So I'm going to quote some of the rah-rah text from the article. 65,853,516, note 16. This odd specificity. Americans voted for Hillary Clinton, giving her a decisive popular vote victory over Donald Trump.
Mm.
So I'm going to stop right there and point out that I still hear this almost every day,
mm-hmm.
even if that number is strictly accurate, which it seems impossible to judge, given my degree of confidence in the election process and the vote count and the machines and everything.
Which, speaking for myself, is zero, but carry on.
Yeah, it's just a fundamental fact that winning the popular vote does not guarantee winning the election. So right off the bat, we see this ongoing meme about the election result, that implying that the election is illegitimate. There's some fundamental unfairness here, or it says something about the outcome, you know, that we should view as important now.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this before, though. In 2000, Gore pretty clearly won the popular vote, although the exact totals, including Florida, are disputed because the recount was not allowed to proceed.
There's that.
So my point is that even in the election of 2000, where there were blatant and obvious dirty tricks at work, including a very suspicious ballot design and a one-off, extremely partisan Supreme Court decision, winning the popular vote entitles you to exactly nothing. Squat, zip, zilch, nada.
Zero.
We continue to trumpet. Continuing to trumpet it may make her supporters feel better, but to the rest of the country, it just makes them look like they're endlessly relitigating the election.
Yeah.
The Verit article continues, "The Clinton coalition remains strong and engaged." Hashtag still with her is a widely used hashtag that reflects a mindset and a mission to fight for a future where love trumps hate. Notice the use of the word trumps. Dignity overcomes division. Equality and justice defeat extremism and bigotry.
Hmm.
So, comma splice aside, I just want to point out that I think these slogans, "with her" and "still with her," are very telling.
Mm-hmm.
We know from the stolen emails that the Clinton campaign debated a list of 84 different slogans.
Yes.
Among them were "rise up," rejected, "keep moving," rejected, It's About You, rejected. Move Ahead, rejected. Progress for People, rejected. Rejected. Your Future, Her Fight, rejected. A Fair Shot and a Fair Deal, rejected. Getting Ahead Together, rejected. Progress for All, rejected. Rejected. Building Tomorrow's America, rejected. Rejected. It's About You, It's About Time, rejected. Rejected. Basically, anything that sounded progressive or populist was rejected.
Rejected. We're not doing that.
For a little while, she was appearing at events with the printed slogan, Fighting for Us, but that disappeared. Yeah. We ultimately got Stronger Together, which was a pointed repudiation of Trump's I Alone Can Fix It, which he was using, he was saying about lots of things, immigration, etc.
Yeah.
And we got I'm With Her, note, not She's With Me.
Yeah.
I'm With Her was a pointed repudiation of the idea that I'm with him.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, explicitly, I'm not with Sanders.
Right.
So, in any case, those things were not inspiring to me, and they were clearly quite partisan and not even popular.
Yeah.
So, the Verrett introduction goes on. Hillary Clinton faced relentless vilification, imbalanced media coverage, and foreign propaganda.
Lots of sexism.
Yeah. It doesn't actually, this article doesn't say that, but a lot of Peter Dow's other stuff talks endlessly about the sexism.
Yeah.
Yet still attracted more votes than any presidential candidate in history except Barack Obama in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to jump in again. First of all, this is damning with faint praise. Every year the voting population is larger. So even if each winning candidate got the exact same percentage of the vote election after election, this would be trivially true. Yes. And in fact, it's actually false because Barack Obama got 65,915,795 votes in the 2012 election.
Yeah.
Beating Clinton's number by 80,279 votes.
But we're not counting.
So even this carefully vetted piece of propaganda, designed to be a truth bomb in the, you know, in a cold world,
there.
Is wrong. Oh. Right.
Yeah.
So why am I doing this nitpicking fact checking? It's because it gets at the whole notion of what Verrett claims to be. So reading on a little bit, with the essence of American democracy at stake, 65.8 million people saw through the lies and smears and made a wise, patriotic choice. Stop laughing.
Sorry.
But they continue to be marginalized and harassed. That would be you.
Oh, sorry.
Verrett's purpose is to become their trusted source of political information and analysis, to provide them and anyone like-minded sanctuary in a chaotic media environment, to center their shared principles, and to do so with an unwavering commitment to truth and facts. Well, he's not off to a great start.
No, I'm clutching my pearls right now.
You're clutching your pearls. So to me, this represents something interesting. It's a news and opinion source, not even specifically tied to a party or to an ideological movement or to courting a particular demographic, but explicitly part of the cult of personality around Clinton herself.
Yeah, it's kind of warped.
It interests me because they're doing a sort of Potemkin cryptography. Verrett posts appear in the form of images with quotes in them. Each image has at the bottom a little box that says something like Verrett.com authentication code 0443117. So when I first saw this, I thought, oh, interesting. They're using cryptographic algorithms to try to fight fake news. I thought maybe each meme image from Verrett was digitally signed. Maybe there was a chain of authentication. What that means is that I thought maybe if you see a Verrett image in the wild on social media, you could validate it cryptographically. There are some different possibilities here. I haven't really put my computer scientist hat on for very long to think about this. But what I initially imagined is that you could save the image. You could go to the Verrett website and upload it. And Verrett could tell you using a message digest algorithm or a digital signature, yes, this is a Verrett image and has not been altered. There are algorithms for doing that, for embedding a watermark or adding a digital signature that could be validated against Verit's key. There are even these steganographic algorithms where you could hide the entire content of an article in the image. So you could run it through a program or upload it to a website and get a whole exploded out hidden text, which would be kind of cool, right? All these things would be kind of cool. And they would be proof, at least moderately proof, against spoofing.
Right.
Different kinds of spoofs and attacks. Another thing I thought possible is, oh, that's neat. Maybe they're using a blockchain algorithm to prove a chain of custody. So I'm not an expert on blockchain algorithms, but I think this would mean other websites along the way, like Twitter and Facebook, would have to provide some technical support to do this validation. But maybe you click on a Verit image and you see that it left Verit at a particular date and time. It was stamped authentic, and then it was imported into Facebook at a date and time and stamped authentic. Or maybe it went through you could see it like a chain of custody.
That's right.
Yeah, that seemed interesting to me. It turns out that Verit does none of these things whatsoever. So there's no useful metadata. There's no chain of custody. There's no interesting big data collection to be done.
No,
no sort of meta-analysis to be done. The idea is, if you see a Verit meme in the wild and you're suspicious of it, that can't be true. The idea is you can go to the Verit website and you type in the verification code. You can't even copy and paste it because it's an image, right?
Oh, hey.
So you have to transcribe it and paste it in.
And then what?
And then it'll take you to the post that has that verification code. And you have to read it for yourself and see, is that the headline of this post? Is that really the headline of this post? And there's not any technology at work there guaranteeing that the image itself hasn't been faked or altered. And I'll get back to that in a minute. The technology is basically you having to do this stenography. You have to type the thing in, look it up, and verify it by hand.
But there's a website. That's something.
There is a website.
Oh, well, there you go.
The next thing I thought, at least they're trying to play the role of fact checker, so they must be providing footnotes and documentation on their site, right? With statistics, links to government documents, Wikipedia articles, whatnot. For example, Clinton's popular vote count over history.
For example, yeah.
They're not really doing that either. If you look at the site, you see that a lot of posts look like this. Verit number 0443120. Hillary Democrats are the heart and conscience of America.
What? Well, I think that's true, but that's what's terrifying.
Anyway, so my point is just that, some of the pieces they're posting have numbers and quotes in them and whatnot that could be run down, but a lot of them are just sheer propaganda.
So it's just propaganda. This is just a propaganda site.
It is a propaganda site. Some of the articles posted, there's stuff about climate change that does link to other sources.
There you go. But it's it's nothing else. It's just propaganda.
Yeah. It's like a closed, I'll mention this in a bit, but it's like the red feed, blue feed.
Oh.
Except in this case, it's not something Facebook did to you, but it's something you yourself signed up for. So that article, Hillary Democrats are the heart and conscience of America, claims Hillary Democrats are the heart and conscience of America. They cast a vote for compassion, inclusion, justice, and equality, the values that made America great. It is a travesty that they continue to be treated with disdain and disrespect. The article notes Clinton's endorsement of Verit and then goes on. The response has been overwhelmingly enthusiastic among Clinton's voters, with hundreds of thousands of site visits, comments, social media follows, signups, emails, etc. Mm-hmm. It validates the purpose of the platform, a place where the shared interests, values, and aspirations of 65.8 million Americans can be centered, free of harassment and hate.
Hmm.
Verrett was met with an entirely predictable response from Clinton's detractors: rage, abuse, bullying, mockery.
Who would do such a thing?
I'll skip ahead, but it goes on. The effort to silence and invisibilize, not a word I'm familiar with, Hillary Clinton and her voters continues unabated since the 2016 election.
Sure, she's not really visible.
She has no media presence whatsoever. In fact, if the frenzy over Verrett's launch is any indication, the hostility has intensified. But that won't deter us from serving the needs and aspirations of our community, no matter how desperate the attacks.
But yet, they persist.
So you see the problem here, like,
yeah,
where when your worldview is that any evidence of criticism only should strengthen your core convictions, mm-hmm. That ain't good. That there's,
if the world hates you, you're doing the Lord's work.
That there's no valid criticism,
right?
Including this,
right?
Anyway. So I want to take a moment to talk about epistemic closure and the paranoid style in American politics.
Yes, please.
For a while now, it's been commonplace among contemporary so-called conservatives to demand the pedigree of any opinion or information source and reject it if it doesn't have a conservative imprimatur. Now, you're a Catholic. Can you explain what an imprimatur is, please?
An imprimatur, it's a note on the inside cover of a book indicating that it has been shown to be free of error by an ordinary, a bishop of some diocese. So the bishop puts his name there,
right,
puts a little cross there and says, boom, this has my imprimatur, it is free of error. It's not an endorsement.
Yeah.
It's simply like, this is free of error.
It's not heretical.
This is not heretical.
Yeah, yeah.
Reading this is not going to lead you astray.
So this term comes from the history of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
Right. So, and I've seen, even today, if you are in a pew and you pull out a booklet or something, you'll see an imprimatur,
yes,
in the back. It's interesting. Anyway.
Oh, in the front, before you start reading.
Okay. In fact, many times I've tried to counter some ridiculous meme on Facebook with an article, and I've been told, essentially, I can't accept anything in that article. It comes from a liberal source.
Hmm.
One particular friend actually used some kind of a site where he would plug in the articles I was linking to, and the site would look at the source, what website is it from, and give him a rating on a conservative-ometer or something like that.
Yeah.
Where it would say, you know, like Salon, bzzz, you know, Huffington Post, eh. And, you know, I'm not incredibly partisan in favor of Huffington Post and Salon, but the thing to point out is these sites are aggregators.
They're aggregators. They're just like crawling the web.
Yeah, very often I see, on Salon especially, it's kind of amusing. I see two posts back to back that take opposite opinions on an issue.
Right. On the same issue.
Yeah. But yes, it's true that they generally lean liberal. Mm-hmm. That's true. But I believe you should look at an argument. You know, look at the facts.
Well, and that's the thing. If you can't evaluate an argument or the facts for yourself, you're in a really bad position.
You are in a really bad position.
Because now you have to rely on someone to tell you what to think.
So this guy, this friend, wasn't willing to look at the facts or the argument at all if it doesn't come from a source that had been vetted by someone as sufficiently conservative.
Right.
Liberals have often been mocked for that sort of behavior, just as they've mocked
conservatives.
I didn't get to edit this like I said.
Oh, right.
Liberals have often mocked them for that sort of behavior, just as they've mocked liberals for being excessively, quote, politically correct, right, and demanding, quote, safe spaces. And of course, I'm uncomfortable with this idea that you would pre-screen the arguments you're exposed to, which is one of the reasons I find things like Facebook's screening of people into red feeds and blue feeds
aberrant,
extremely dangerous and, you know, pernicious and disturbing, given that it isn't clearly something you opted into, and that there's no big knob on your Facebook feed to say, okay, show me the rest of the world, mm-mm, you know, show me what I'm getting.
Right.
And adjust it as you prefer.
Right.
I'm telling you now, though I think Verit is pretty laughable and will ultimately fail, I'm very disturbed that it exists, and I'm even more disturbed that Dear Leader Clinton would endorse it. It says a lot about her. It's a pretty clear example of conservative libertarians being dead right about the liberal tendency towards fascism.
Yeah.
Epistemic closure has a technical definition in informal logic, but it's come to mean in political thought the idea that one can, and some do, knowingly inhabit an echo chamber of like-minded people, holding opinions similar to yours, deliberately excluding or distrusting any information or opinion originating outside that bubble.
Yeah.
So what Verit does is create a bubble not around an ideology or party, but around a personality. To me, this is more disturbing than the idea that someone is just a relentless Fox News listener or Rush Limbaugh dittohead fan. Yeah. There is no technological fix to fake news and epistemic closure because fake news is shared and believed by people who want to share and believe it.
They like it that way.
Epistemic closure happens when people want a safe, closed space that reinforces their beliefs. There are technological tools that could be used to help validate sources and open bubbles for people who seek to climb out of them, but Verit does nothing whatsoever along those lines.
Right.
Already there are sites that will let you create a fake Verit meme. So the first one I created said, "Liberals are responding to the way the right has locked itself into a closed epistemological bubble by ... locking themselves in their own closed epistemological bubble." This meme had Verit.com authentication code 0192889. If I put that number into the search window on the real Verit website, it comes back with nothing and says, "We can't find the Verit you're looking for. Try searching again." But that wasn't really the point, because I can share the fake one just as easily and widely as someone else can share a real one, and who's going to look it up?
Yeah. Snopes will.
So what does Verit really do? I was joking to Grace about it, saying, "Do you want to have a ministry of truth? Because this is how you get a ministry of truth. It's extremely Orwellian, complete with two-minute ritualized hatred projected daily towards Bernie bros."
Yeah. I hate them.
I think that evaluating your sources relentlessly and seeking sources outside your bubble is a very important and a relevant thing to do. I have nothing but contempt for people on the conservative side who seek out only writing an opinion that strengthens their confirmation biases. And of course, I have to admit that I often am guilty of this kind of thing, and we all are, despite my best efforts to read or at least skim across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. Doing that regularly is one of the biggest reasons that I can't place myself squarely on a single, one-dimensional liberal to conservative axis.
Yeah.
Because you realize that on different issues, you can have a variety of opinions and affinities for ideas.
Right.
If you're looking at the ideas as ideas outside of that, that aren't pre-screened and pre-rated as to their conservative
pre-vetted
or liberal affinity.
Mm-hmm.
A reasonable person might think that this is frightening, but not really important, because it represents a small minority of dead-enders. And that's true in a sense, because Clinton has only a 30% approval rating in the most recent polls.
Lower than Trump.
Which is lower than Trump at 36%.
Sorry.
So, I think this is important, though, because...
Run her again, Democrats, see what happens.
But, you know, it's all about the sexism and the Bernie bros. I think this is important because a lot of those who are hashtag still with her are quite powerful and influential people. If they get on board with Verit and Dear Leader Madam Secretary's grievance book tour, they're essentially engaging in an act of political escapism. They're reading only fan fiction about the world. So looking at the claim... The claims in Clinton's new book, it's clear she's essentially continuing her campaign of grievances. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be a Festivus for Democrats, an airing of grievances. Unlike Festivus, which is supposed to be for the rest of us, this is a campaign for the few, convincing themselves that they are for the many.
Yeah. Compassion.
There's a saying quality. That great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, small minds discuss people.
Oh, yeah.
I'll leave it to the reader to decide what kind of mind he or she possesses and wants to cultivate.
Indeed.
Okay, so that's my essay.
That's all right.
Thank you. Any thoughts you haven't already interjected?
Oh, yeah, I interject a lot. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It made it more fun. I don't think it's so much fun to just hear me sit here and read an essay.
Well, I do think all these, I think these ideas and these concepts are related, right?
Uh-huh.
To all the things that matter to me. And that's why we're talking about it.
Right.
And I feel like in some ways it's a good segue into other things we want to talk about today. But I really feel like the one thing I want to say, and I'll unpack just a little bit more,
okay,
is how much more I fear her as a fascist than really anyone else around. And because there's lots of fascism going around, and Americans like to think of fascism as swastikas and goose stepping and white hoods.
Yeah. Now, I was hoping you'd talk a little more about this, because you've often referred to Clinton, do they know she's a fascist? But I think that does need, people will need some convincing about that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what's so dangerous. People need convincing about her fascism. They literally can't see it. It's not obvious to them. Because they're looking for swastikas and white hoods and someone using racial epithets and so on.
Yeah.
And so 45 comes out and does that, and people are like, ah, ha, ha, fascist.
Now they can see it.
Now they can see it. I'm like, but, okay, never mind.
No, what she illustrates to me over and over again is basically a lack of principles. And I know people jump on me for that, but I don't have any other way of explaining her constantly, her constant adjustments in her worldviews and her defensiveness about any personal criticism and making any criticism personal.
Right.
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 That it's an opportunist of the highest order. She has no deep political values or principles. No. It's about her. And in fact, she made that the campaign, she just settled on the campaign slogan, "You're with me." Right. Yeah. So, and to me, that's not the kind of leader that I'm looking for and haven't ever been.
Well, and just because people like to do it and like to godwin the conversation, I'll just go there. That's what was so endemic to both Hitler and to Mussolini, was their cults of personality.
Cults of personality.
Yeah, that people were just about them. And 45's got that too. I'm not letting 45 off the hook. I'm just not talking about
him
right
now. Right. Yeah.
But the reason I'm talking about this and Secretary Clinton is because she's more dangerous because we don't recognize her.
We don't recognize her because she fits within that nicely within the Overton window of polite discourse.
It's polite discourse, but we can talk about it.
But we talk about Trump all the time. Like, people recognize his narcissism.
Right.
It's pretty damn obvious.
Right.
But no one talked about her narcissism.
And who was one of my more radical tinfoil friends was like, they're the same person. Can't you see they're the same person?
I wouldn't go exactly there, but
one person fits inside the Overton window, one person doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's the difference.
But certainly, they both seem very narcissistic. People give her credit for an awful lot of policy analysis and savvy that I just don't
never saw.
See.
Never saw.
Well, and I went looking for it.
Yeah,
in several elections, went looking for
it's not there
for her consistent platform, for her consistent views, for her support, genuine support of
anything good,
of anything good, of people below her in class, of people outside her color bubble, all the.
Well, you didn't find it because it didn't exist.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so to be very, very precise. Fascism, you'll read lots of definitions. The quick and dirty definition that I like and that I think is most accurate comes from the horse's mouth. Mussolini described it as a perfect marriage between the corporation and the state.
And that's what we've always been getting at when we're talking about You know, her speeches, her speeches, Goldman Sachs,
yeah, public-private partnerships.
Even on her book tour, apparently she's charging like what, $1,000 a ticket?
Well, I think it's just $600. You know,
but
you don't want to exclude people,
right? So if you keep it under $1,000, you know, all the worthwhile people can attend.
All the worthwhile people can get in there. So the
are you going to have a copy of her book under the Christmas tree for me?
Oh, honey.
Sorry.
Try not to keep it dirty.
Keep going.
So I think standing on that definition alone, I think a lot of people should be able to draw lines between the dots. But just in case you can't, I want to bring up the American carceral state.
Oh, yeah. A little thing.
Just a little thing.
A little $1 trillion thing. A
little $1 trillion gambit.
Yeah.
And if you really step far enough back, what you see is that our public school system is effectively just a dumping ground to pump children into the prison system and use their labor, extract for next to nothing, to enrich corporations.
Yep.
And you know, it's hard if that's not clear to you when I just say that. If that's not an aha moment for you,
you're not reading enough.
You're not reading enough, and not even that. We need to have a longer conversation.
Yeah,
I'm not going to unpack that here.
We should unpack that in another podcast
at this time. Yeah. But that should be obvious if you're keeping up with some of the reading, and if that doesn't terrify you, that everyone glorifies and cheers for this woman. Who really sort of kicked the ball rolling for the modern carceral state in rhetoric and policy that she endorsed, supported, and encouraged. I got nothing for you.
But super predators, Grace.
I know, they're terrifying. It's
Trump, you know, Trump called for the execution of the Central Park Five.
He's a bad man. But, you know, at least you didn't leave home to go execute a mentally disabled man, because that would be wrong.
That would be wrong.
Yeah.
All right.
And, you know, and my true joy is that none of this has made me bitter.
Well, that's the, like, to me, reading Verrett and the comment sections on these posts are a little bit like looking under a log in the forest, right?
All these things come crawling out.
Because people are bitter, right, and they're channeling their bitterness down and to the left. Down and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this meme that, you know, it's all about the Bernie bros and whatnot ignores the fact that far more women supported Sanders than men did.
Did you know that Julian Assange is a scumbag? Total scumbag. Worse than Nader.
So I'm going to, maybe I'll spend some time reading the comment section. But again, I mean, when they're among friends, liberal, progressive, Democrats, feminist, you know, anti-racist or whatever, are fascist.
Absolute fascist. Absolute fascist. It's revolting.
Yeah.
And so that's why I have a thing about liberals.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to.
Anyway, I think, you know, this is just, what? I mean, they've when Reagan was mocking liberals, I was standing up as a proud liberal.
Mm. Yeah, well,
But I can't feel comfortable with that tag on myself anymore.
That moniker, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have liberal views on many things, but as far as what comprises a modern liberal.
Yeah.
You know, in Hillary Clinton's campaign logo, it was a red arrow pointing to the right. Right? Made out of her initial. And I'm like, that ain't liberal. Yeah. And I ain't going there.
Nope.
I'm not with her.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, no, I'm liberal about butter.
You definitely are liberal about butter. Eggs, pesto. And,
very liberal about pesto.
Avocado, garlic.
I'm a little too liberal about garlic, so the sometimes kids say, they're like, Mom, that pesto, I couldn't even eat that.
Yeah, well.
Like, but more for me.
They'll learn. All right, so.
So I think this is actually why I think this is, I want to say some more about last week's topic on protest.
Yeah, and, we got a comment.
We got a comment!
And actually a follow-up comment.
Yeah, oh really? Was there more and I just missed it? Or?
No, I mean, okay. She posted, I responded, she posted again, so.
Yeah, so that's kind of amazing. We're very excited that people comment and are happy
Yay,
to respond
comments.
To you. Yes.
It might take us a while. I mean, our time is a little constrained but we'll do our best.
But the people in power are not your friend.
No.
They're not your friend. And really this guy's basic thesis, which he buried, his thesis is that, you know, your best bet is to align yourself with power and protest and convince those people in the echelons of power to help you make this happen.
Who are you talking about now? This guy?
This guy, the author of the book review last week in the New Yorker.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
Yeah, not the guy in this room.
There in your head, but none of us saw you go there.
Oh, sorry. I do that a lot. Yeah. Forgive me.
Anyway.
So the author of last week's review in the New Yorker.
Yeah.
The critic at large.
Concluding that maybe the best way for the voiceless to be heard is to work within the system.
Is to work within the system and keep protesting in the streets.
Yeah.
Good job, everybody. Good luck not getting arrested. But seeding the agenda to the powerful means you have to shift your agenda to theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Hashtag, I'm with her.
Right. So whatever your agenda was, you have to move to their agenda. And you may even, over time, forget...
Your own agenda.
Your own agenda.
Sure.
And embrace it as... And embrace their agenda as yours, and be a mouthpiece for them.
Oceania has always been at war with East Asia.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
So, in the black community, you end up with a white agenda.
And you convince yourself that it's the same.
That's the same thing as my own agenda, is what I always wanted.
These are universal principles.
Yeah.
I don't even see color.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Well, no.
It's because I'm colorblind, but.
That's an aside. I think the textbook example of this in the black community is that integration is what we're working for.
Oh, yeah.
As if the problem that blacks were facing is that they didn't live around enough white people. And if they only lived around white people, that would fix everything?
Or the idea that if you force enough white people to live around black people, they'll magically become not racist.
Not racist. Like, that's the problem. And so we need to integrate to solve the problem. And suddenly reparations is off the table. Suddenly repatriating people is off the table. Suddenly,
Really supporting, like, a strong black community that's separate
is off the table
how valuable that might actually be,
or even just leaving black communities the hell alone,
right,
is off the table.
Not you know, forcing them into environmentally degraded areas or building a freeway
that's just the free market.
If they had enough political clout, they wouldn't have to have a freeway running through their backyard.
Yeah, so, you know, oh well.
Or front yard in some cases.
Too sad, so sad, so bad.
They wouldn't have a brownfield, you know, flooding their basements.
Good grief. As if that's the problem, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And suddenly, black voices, black agendas, black perspectives are not just erased, but obliterated. Annihilated. And, you know, Malcolm X is the devil. And you can't talk about anything he's doing because, you know, he's a revolutionary and violent and dangerous. And so on.
So let me just try to fill in. So when I do an algebra problem, I have to do some extra steps.
Oh, sorry.
To get... If you go along with this premise that the best way to protest is the approved way.
It's the approved way.
You have to exclude from your worldview anything that seems actually radical or revolutionary.
Or anything. And really kind of reshape your own thinking, the thinking what the powerful want you to think. And I don't mean to spoil this for you, but when you do that, it benefits the powerful.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. They win in that exchange.
Yep, yep.
But
won't they drop a few crumbs off the table for you?
If they so deign to.
Or some stuff might maybe trickle down from them. I don't know what that stuff is.
It ain't
manna, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Yeah, no, that's not how it works. Yeah. What's that meme? That's not how that works. That's not how any of this works. No, that's not how it... No. No. They want you to think these things and adopt this agenda because it benefits them.
Yes.
And that's the point. Which brings me to my second thing. The powerful are not on your side, and that's just a lie. That's just a lie. Mm-hmm. And this piece... And I think I said it directly, but I didn't sort of unpack that at all. This piece is a piece of propaganda to that end, yeah. To tell you that lie. But it's what I like to call stealth propaganda. You think you're reading an article or an interview or a book review or whatever, but it's actually a piece of propaganda meant to reshape the way you think. So you think you've read an article and you're focusing on the topic at hand. Mm-hmm.
On these books about the history of protests. And look, you've learned something.
You've learned something.
I mean, I learned something.
Yeah, I learned something. It was good. So. But what it's done with this little background seed of an idea mm-hmm. is it's slowly reshaping the way you think about things. You know, yeah, you're right. We've got all this evidence here. Yeah, this is the best way to protest. And you never notice that, you know, maybe Robert F. Kennedy's idea of the world isn't the same as mine. And maybe I don't necessarily want to be on his team.
You know, if they hadn't gotten to Frodo in time, that fragment of the Morgul blade would have worked all the way into his heart and turned him into a wraith, smaller and less powerful and under their control.
Exactly. No, I'm sorry. It's just a little...
Too on the nose.
Too on the nose.
Okay, so Elrond, tell us the spell of healing.
Well, it's difficult. You have to read widely. You have to read critically. And there's, I don't know that this education is on offer anymore anywhere.
No, a true classical education prepares you for a life of dissent from day one.
From day one.
Right.
You should always look critically. You should always look with as clear eyes as you can have.
Yeah, yeah.
And catechize yourself on truth.
Yeah.
Right? But I'll give you another example because I want you to try and start to see this mm-hmm. because it's all over the place. The other example I saw was during the 2012 election with Mitt Romney. I kept seeing all these utterly freakish articles, right? Just these freakish, like the one that I think I got the most response to when I posted it was, and I posted it without comment, wondering if anyone would see what I was looking at.
Right.
Was this gay Mormon who was married and had children, married to a woman and had children and was living out a heterosexual lifestyle, even though he was a gay man. And everyone's like, what? And they're talking back and forth about this. Mm-hmm. And they keep referring to him as a mainline Protestant Christian. I want to just tell everybody that Mormons are not mainline Protestant Christians.
We actually talked about this in a previous podcast, but I think it was one of the ones that I haven't reshared because we wound up getting pretty down and dirty with our language. It's pretty salty.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually just a sailor in real life. I'm sorry about that.
They call them merchant marines.
Merchant marines, yeah. Got it. Okay.
But no, this was something we called out and talked about, which was it not to hate on... Latter-day Saints.
Not at all.
Per se. But it was strange, and we thought worthy of notice, that Romney as a candidate, suddenly a world in which Kennedy was too Catholic to be electable for some people.
Latter-day Saints are mainline Christians.
Latter-day Saints are presented as basically evangelicals.
Right,
as if there were no historical, theological differences, and as if their tradition was not pretty damn weird.
Well, and as if there aren't modern cultural differences of note.
Right. Right.
And that was done as a propaganda move to normalize Romney as a Latter-day Saint.
To normalize his religion, his...
Right.
And all his practices, which, you know, again, not to mock per se, but are odd and definitely out of mainstream American Christian thought, or were.
No, I believe in the virgin birth. I'm not... ready to criticize anybody about their religious beliefs.
Right. That's weird. No, I mean, weird. Any religion worth its salt.
It's pretty damn
you have to believe in some pretty out there things.
Right. Some things that really stretch credulity.
Yeah.
So this should not be taken in any way, shape, or form as a criticism of Latter-day Saints.
No.
And frankly, I have deep respect for them, and I really feel like the Catholic bishops need to take a moment and learn a few things from them.
Like why it's growing so fast.
Like why it's growing so fast. The movement is growing. And specifically, how well they've embraced
solidarity
and works of mercy.
And how well they take care of their own.
Right. Right. It's really something important. I think we could learn a lot as Catholics from them.
It is important. And Protestants could learn something too.
Right. So I don't want this to in any way seem like me denigrating Latter-day Saints.
But you're pointing out that this piece, which was allegedly a debate I'll just say gay marriage because it sounds like you're saying gay marriage.
All right.
But I mean about a gay man getting married.
Right.
And about that debate was, as you point out, was sort of slyly a piece trying to normalize
the Latter-day Saints as a mainstream religion.
Right.
And I saw it over and over again that there would be some salacious headline. Mm-hmm. And as a very subtle subtext, by the way, Latter-day Saints are just this mainline Protestant religion. Perhaps you've not heard of them.
In college, they were one of the groups that I studied in some depth in a class that was called American Sects and Cults.
And cults, and right.
We studied...
That was not that long ago.
No, just the 80s.
Right, so it needs to be understood that propaganda shift to change American perception, to move American perception about Latter-day Saints, that was a conscious move.
Mm-hmm.
And stories were placed with these salacious headlines, so people read them, they talked about them, they picked them apart, and never noticed the subtext.
Yeah.
So there'll be this subtext, which is plainly stated, actually, much like this guy says directly, support the powerful. Or rather, you need the powerful to be successful.
Right.
That subtext will be there in print, but it will be so below the salacious nature of the content.
Below the radar.
They
call that a buried lead.
A buried lead. That you're just going to absorb that information over and over again until maybe you just think you think it.
You just think you think it. I've always thought that way.
Yeah, I've always thought that
way. I've always been with her.
Yeah. Why wouldn't I be? And so that's the idea. And the idea in this piece and the idea in many of these things is to shift your sense of comfort and security with the elites. So, you know,
interesting.
You're not in a position to, I don't know, resist them in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just a quick little side about resistance. A note to all my fans. If you are in the resistance, you're not supposed to tell anyone.
I am definitely with the resistance. Ooh, that's so hot. Dude, she's never going to sleep with you. In Star Wars joke.
Star Wars, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So I think the last thing we were going to talk about today.
Firmly in the friend zone. Sorry.
You know, the friend zone doesn't exist. Well, come on, stop. The last thing we wanted to talk about was living in protest. Is that
living in protest?
Yeah,
it was a good. It was something you brought up at the end of our last discussion.
Yeah. That I
more important to you since you basically felt like you had more or less retired from the kind of marches, and parade, protest.
Living in protest, and I think the key, the only thing I actually have on that list, is to perform the works of mercy, and that will always and everywhere be a protest.
Interesting. Can you? I mean, not everyone listening is, catechized Catholic.
Okay. Yeah. That a lot of people know what the works of mercy are, though. I mean, don't they?
If you grew up Protestant like me, if you grew up as a Presbyterian, you never heard those things.
Oh. So the works of mercy. There are seven works of, and bless my heart if I can remember all 14 of them. There are seven corporal works of mercy.
This is a test.
I know. They said there wouldn't be a test. I thought I'd pass them all.
They lied.
So there are seven corporal works of mercy and seven spiritual works of mercy.
Even if you want to just mention a few of them, I think that would make you.
So corporal works of mercy, you know, for the body, to care for the body, to care for the
physical
the
person.
Physical person.
Yeah.
Feeding the hungry, drink to the thirsty, housing the homeless, caring for the sick, visiting the imprisoned, clothing the naked. I said tending the sick already. There's one more. I've forgotten what it is.
Burying the dead.
Burying the dead. Yes.
The Protestant knows.
The Protestant knows. Burying the dead. Remember, you will die. It's true. That happens to everyone.
Memento mori.
So doing those things every day will always and everywhere be a protest. Because who is there that hasn't been buried?
Mm-hmm.
It's only the people, or they've been buried in shallow graves. It's only the marginalized.
Mm-hmm. The marginalized. Who are the people not being fed?
Not being fed. It's only the marginalized. And it's in the interest of the powerful to not feed them. Who is it that doesn't have clean water?
Flint.
Textbook of the marginalized.
Yep.
It's in the interest of the powerful for them not to have clean water.
That would be expensive.
That would be expensive. It'd be a thing, you know? Yeah, we can't do a thing because, you know, it's expensive.
They start to feel like they're above their station.
Exactly. And we can't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it that's without clothing? Who is it that's imprisoned? Who is it that is sick? Those are the people at the margins, the powerful, are intentionally disenfranchising. So if you re-enfranchise those people, you will always, always be acting in protest of what the powerful want.
Interesting. And, you know, this is, I get from what I've learned from you directly and kind of absorbed by osmosis,
right,
that essentially the church's spiritual teaching, this church's teaching on social justice issues,
right,
is and always will be radical. And if it's not considered radical, it needs to be revised.
It needs to be revised.
Until it is.
Right. And I think, and that's why it hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, this is the root of the matter.
But aren't you really just an SJW?
No. I am not.
That's social justice warrior.
Social justice warrior.
When I hear that epithet, actually, I stand up and say, why would I not be?
Right.
No, I'm against social justice of any kind.
Yeah,
I hate justice, you know.
Yeah, I'm opposed to that.
Anyway, so you, physical.
And then there's spiritual.
Corporal works of mercy.
There's a corporal works of mercy. Then there's spiritual works of mercy. I'm really going to forget some on this one, but it's educating the ignorant, counseling the doubtful, comforting the sorrowful,
mm-hmm.
Praying for the marginalized. I think that's actually that you are supposed to pray for people who are in danger.
Mm-hmm.
I only have four. Oh, that's why I only remember four. Three of them are actually people who like to practice the spiritual works of mercy by correcting. That's one of them. Is correcting.
Oh, is it really
the wrong? Yes, correcting people in error is a spiritual work of mercy, right?
Yeah,
and people love that one.
They love that one.
But there's actually the church understands that, or the church teaches rather, that three of these. One of them is correcting those in error. Isn't exactly for everybody. It's only for people who know what they're doing. So, in other words, if you are a surgeon.
Yeah, right.
You get to correct other people about surgery if you're a good surgeon.
Right.
But if you're not a surgeon, you shouldn't correct someone else's surgery. And that's
the idea. Let's talk about your doctrine.
Let's talk about your doctrine. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So now if you're not a theologian, you're not supposed to be correcting other people's theological errors.
Yeah, and where I see this applying is, you see this a lot between the left and the far left. The liberals and the left, where they're blasting away at each other about their ideology.
But their ideology. Like, bam, bam, bam. Right.
And what I hear is mostly, like you hear on spiritual matters, total sola scriptura ignorance.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's why that's a heresy.
Oh, God. One of my friends on Twitter posted something that said, modern progressivism isn't anything new. It's just recycled Marxism. I'm like, if I thought you knew what any of those words mean... I might like to talk about this with you. Anyway, sorry, go on.
And yet, you know, someone needs to talk about it with you.
Yes.
But that, so there are spiritual works of mercy which aren't for everybody, right?
Yeah.
And they don't elaborate, this is for you and this is for you person by person, but rather
you
need to have enough catechesis to understand where you are.
What's for you?
What's
you know what this reminds me of?
Mm-hmm.
There are yogas.
Right.
Right. And some people are drawn towards a yoga of meditation and isolation, you know, like a withdrawal from society,
right,
and whatnot.
Right.
Some people, their spiritual practice is and should be, because of who they are, work, building
right.
houses,
right.
you know, because that's what they're called to. So that sounds to me
here.
Like these different praxis, mm-hmm. these different yogas, these different forms of work, what you yoke yourself to.
So if you make a commitment to pray for the marginalized every day,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be and here's the thing. I should also do a little sidebar about how prayer works. There's a lot of what's the word I'm looking for? Disdain?
Yeah. For prayer.
For prayer. Like, yeah, that, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with
well,
you.
There's
a truckload of thoughts and prayers coming.
That's a rightful calling out of people who are going to do nothing other than claim to offer thoughts and prayers.
But prayer works. And you see that like it's a bumper sticker, right? Prayer works.
Yeah.
But no one talks about its mechanism.
Right.
Right? Something I personally like to say is that everything you do and see catechizes you. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing you see on a daily basis that doesn't change you on your interior, right? Doesn't make you a different person.
No, true.
Right?
My father's spiritual master and different aspects of the Buddhist tradition kind of teach it as you become what you meditate on.
Right. So this practice of prayer changes you, informs you, occupies you,
mm-hmm.
quite literally, and
Occupy Gray Street.
And then you are prepared and ready to act only after you've engaged in prayer. So when you pray for the marginalized, you have been reformed.
And you've primed your pumps.
You've primed your pumps
yeah.
to act on their behalf.
Right. No, that's kind of how I picture prayer working is.
Right.
It's the same. It's exactly the same as prep for just about anything.
It
does. So when I'm studying or whatnot, or when I'm working on a problem, oftentimes it's not, even if I'm learning a guitar piece or something, mm-hmm. it's not that I'm learning the piece. It's that I'm becoming a guitarist who can play the piece.
Right.
You know, or I'm becoming a scholar who can write the essay, you know.
Right.
And you changing your, what really changes is not just getting the work done, it's
right.
you're changing yourself.
Exactly. And so that's really why that's my lead for spiritual works of mercy is prayer.
Uh-huh.
And then really people, count, you know, like sort of comforting the afflicted.
Yeah.
Like, or you know, the sorrowful, someone. So you bury the dead and then you comfort the people who are left behind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's your job. And that's where you're led and where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And again, the powerful pray, P-R-E-Y, on the sorrowful, openly,
yeah.
nakedly.
Yeah.
And if they don't receive your comfort, they will be ripe for the picking.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're they're a chess piece in the spiritual warfare.
Really,
in a spiritual chess game.
Really, and I will often talk in spiritual terms, and people always think I'm being funny. And to be fair,
sometimes you are.
Sometimes I am. Almost always I am. Right? You know, how do you know I'm being sarcastic? My mouth is open. That's how you know.
Right.
Or you know, I'm making a comment. That's how
right.
you know.
Right.
But I'm also very serious.
Yeah.
Right? That these metaphysical realities are realities and they are a part of what happened for us and part of what we're experiencing.
Yeah.
And so you shouldn't lose sight of the spiritual works of mercy either.
No.
Yeah, and that's a life lived in protest. And how does that look on paper? What do we do? I don't like to enumerate too specifically.
What we're going to get arrested for next?
Yeah. Or too specifically, like even not arrested. I don't want to go on about who I gave money to supported or how I supported them.
No, I mean, there's an injunction against that in the Bible. You should not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Right. And, you know, and we have supported people in various ways, and I'm not going to trumpet them or discuss that their names
any further.
You know?
Or mention that any further, because that's...
It's not about us.
It's not about us, and it's a private thing.
When we are in a position to do something material like that, I mostly just feel grateful that I am in that position.
I'm able to do it.
Yeah.
It's an honor to be able to.
Yeah.
So there's that. But I think our homeschooling is a very specific...
Mission.
Uh-huh. In that, you know, educating the ignorant.
Yeah.
And again, this is all about, and I use the term catechesis, which is frequently used in a religious setting, but it has secular meaning. It's it's a word with meaning, in that you are taught the framework of how to understand the world, right?
Yep.
That's what catechesis is.
And
so it's important to me that my children are catechized to beauty and to truth and to love. And that's actually the core of it right there. And that's not going to happen for them in school.
In a public school or in private schools, sure.
Most parochial schools.
Right.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And so that's, I feel that's part of my work and part of my protest.
I've even come to believe that this isn't our agenda.
No.
But if we did nothing to explicitly educate the kids other than keep them out of these toxic environments, and just let them explore, you know, our libraries, our knowledge, and interact with them as growing adults to their capacity, mm-hmm. you know, each day about different things.
Right.
That would be a win.
That would be a win. We're ahead.
That's not where, I mean, we don't stop there.
We don't stop there. And that's not necessarily even our...
Our explicit agenda. Explicit but agenda, we yeah. believe that the situation is that bad, that just keeping them out of school is a win.
It's a win, yeah.
It's the start of a big win.
Yeah.
So
that's one thing. My permaculture stuff, my distributist stuff, my work with the American Solidarity Party.
Yeah.
All those things. The little bit of writing I am able to do for Solidarity Hall and for the Distributist Review.
Right.
And I'm doing a little speaking thing at Front Porch Republic this year in Holland, Michigan.
Yeah.
But those are the things that I'm doing that, I think are worthwhile.
Well, I want to mention writing, because to me, what you talk about as protest, mm-hmm. I think of as dissent. And I personally, we have our different yogas, what we're yoked to do, what we feel compelled to do, and what we feel good at. And I can't go a week without writing, without honestly feeling spiritually sick and compelled to get something done, to get something written. Mm-hmm. And so this is, I like to joke, can I be excused from the agrarian revolution? I have very soft hands. but that's who I am and have always been, is I write mm-hmm. and study and read. And I want to do that in dissent as I can. And then I also feel compelled recently. We've done pretty well about getting these things out weekly.
Woo-hoo!
And I really want to continue.
Oh, gosh. You guys have no idea what a win that is.
It's a huge win to do anything on a regular basis, get anything finished.
Right.
But I feel like this is part of my mission. Mm-hmm. Can I bring it around and do a callback and kind of bring us to a close or near close?
Yeah.
So this idea, you become what you meditate on. Very powerful idea, and I think it should apply to everyone, and we really should be considering what we fill our heads with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're studying policy and looking forward and trying to, think every day about how you can assist the underdogs, how you can punch up and help you know, reach down to help mm-hmm. people. And, you know, what can we really do locally working outwards?
Yeah.
That primes you to be a certain kind of person and to live a certain kind of life.
Right.
If you're spending your time in a closed political bubble, nursing your grievances,
you're a different person.
You're a different person, and you're priming yourself and creating yourself to relitigate old battles on behalf of someone who really doesn't give a shit about you.
Like at all. Okay, like at all. I just want to be clear about that.
Yes. So, are we, have we covered the topic long enough to cover the topic short enough to keep it interesting?
I think so.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very, very much for joining me, and thanks for letting me read that long ranty essay. And
oh, it's my pleasure.
For your comments.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Take care, everyone.
Have a good week.
Bye-bye.